Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Mentorship Matters with Dave and Liz. And on this podcast, we share our thoughts on topics of mentorship and career paths and how to really succeed as a corporate and securities lawyer. And I'm Dave Lynn, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by my co-host, Liz Dunshee, as well as our very esteemed guest, Keir Gumbs, who's general counsel at Edward Jones. Keir and I worked together in the chief counsel's office in the Division of Corporation Finance at the SEC. And what seems like just yesterday, but I just did the math and it was 22 years ago.
Oh,
So
don't remind me, Dave. That's too long.
But after leaving the SEC, Keir basically went on to pretty much do it all. Everything you could do as a practicing securities lawyer. He worked in Covington in the law firm world for several years and then worked in-house at Uber, at Broadridge, and now at Edward Jones. Keir, thanks so much for joining us today.
Dave, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
We wanted to start off just wanted to ask you more generally. You've had such a diverse and accomplished career, and how have mentors really played a role in your development? And what advice would you give to a young lawyer who wants to do corporate and securities work in terms of how should they find mentors and get guidance and look for types of opportunities to develop in the way that you did?
Well, first thing, I'm counting you among those mentors. So let me give
Oh,
you your
great.
flowers now on this on this call. I think I've been really lucky in my career. I've been really lucky in life, honestly, more lucky than good for sure. And what a part of that luck has been having really great people that I've come across at almost every stage of my career who've been willing to serve as mentors or to help me, coach me, guide me throughout the process. As I say to my wife all the time, I'm not a big fan of therapy. I don't like therapy, but I like coaches. I like coaches. And I found I've had some really amazing coaches over the years. I still have coaches, by the way. It's not something that ends when you sit in the seat of a general counsel or really anywhere else. And to be specific, when I think my biggest stroke of luck, other than my wife saying yes, is going to the SEC at such an early stage in my career and having the opportunity to work with so many phenomenal securities lawyers. Obviously, two of the most significant mentors of my life, one of whom you've worked with for many, many years in the form of Marty Dunn. Very, very fortunate to have worked with Marty at the SEC, had him as a mentor at the SEC and beyond. And another one is David Martin. And another one is actually Paula Dubberly. And I want to talk about all three of them because it ties to the question about the advice I'd give to young securities lawyers. With Marty, where I felt really lucky over the years is that. And I don't know that I deserved any of it, but I think Marty saw someone who really liked securities law, who was really committed to being a great lawyer and understanding the rules and the no action letters. And, you know, I still think fondly about when I was running the shareholder proposal task force and I'd write a memo. And as part of the tradition, then Marty would look at it and he'd write his comments. And when I got like a great work at the top of the memo, I wanted to like frame that thing, man. It made me feel so good. And Marty also gave me tough feedback when I was there about places where maybe my thought process wasn't as thorough as it should have been. My research wasn't as good. My writing wasn't as clear. And so I'm just really grateful for all of that feedback during my time at the SEC. Tied to that, there was a point where Paula Dubberly was my boss when I was in the chief counsel's office. And there was a real pivotal moment in my career at the SEC. So this may surprise some people. There was a while where I had a side job, so to speak. I was promoting parties and I was doing events and all kinds of things, which you can do while you work at the agency, as long as you disclosed it, which I did. And I remember there was one day where it was like the movies. I'd come in, I'd work in the office from say 7:30 or 8 to like 6. I'd go home, I'd change my clothes, and then I'd be out promoting events from like 9 o'clock till 3 in the morning. It's how I met my wife, by the way. And I remember one day I was maybe coming in, you know, the following morning and I was dragging and Paula came in and she closed the door behind her. And she's like, basically, is this the best that you can do? Like, here, are you giving your everything to this job? Like, you can continue doing what you're doing right now and it would be just fine. But I think you're better than that. And I want to challenge you to ask, like, what is it that you really want as a lawyer? Do you want to be a lawyer? Do you want to do something else? And what I appreciated about that, there was so much, but the fact that she saw something She had the courage as my leader to come in and have a direct conversation with me. And she gave me kind of optionality, right? Like, I see something, I'm saying something, and I'm leaving it to you to decide. And to be candid, it was like the right time for me to have that conversation, because it frankly made me rethink, do I really want to really dedicate myself to being an amazing securities lawyer? Or do I want to go and do something else? Or do I want to just be mediocre? And it just completely changed the way I felt about my job and showing up and giving my best and all of those sorts of things. And I don't know that Paula even remembers having that conversation. It was like, as you said, it's probably like 25 years ago, but it was such a meaningful conversation for me. And then the last one is with David Martin. And I was thinking about leaving the SEC, and I was talking to people at other law firms just saying, hey, I'm thinking about leaving, and can you tell me what it's like on the other side? And I had this conversation with David, and two things came out of that conversation. One is he said, here you are, if you come here, I want to try to make you help you make partner at this firm. But in doing so, I'm going to be your Dutch uncle. And I was like, I don't know what the hell a Dutch uncle is. Like, I don't, okay, what does that mean? I had to look it up afterwards. What a Dutch uncle is, it's someone who behind closed doors is very, very tough on you, very, very challenging on you. But publicly, you walk on water. And that was what David Martin was for me. I remember we would have conversations, like heated conversations. Is this a semicolon or a colon that goes here? Kier, did you need this many words? You said the Securities Act of 1934. Did you mean to say the Securities? Like little things that really made a difference. And so that leads to kind of what advice I would give people. The first thing from Marty and from David is that commitment to excellence, like trying to be your best at all times. I'm still very much in learning mode. I can be better in so many ways as a leader, as a writer, as a communicator, et cetera. And I think to be a really good lawyer, you have to have that commitment to the craft. I am committed to the craft. I want to be great at this. I want to be great at being a securities lawyer, understanding the law. So that's one piece. Second piece is asking for feedback and having the space to accept it and act on it. And again, I'm not perfect at it, but David, you've given me great, tough feedback at times in my career. Marty has, David Martin did, certainly Paula did. And had I not been in the right place to receive that feedback, I wouldn't have grown from it. And it's terrible when you're the person giving feedback for the recipient not to do anything with it. And so I think that's the second thing. And then the last one is, try to meet your heroes. I feel very fortunate. I've met many of my heroes in the securities bar. I am a totally open securities law nerd. And so when I see people who are like, that was a great no action letter, or you did a great job on this disclosure or whatever, I tell them that. And I want to understand, how did you think about that thing? How did you draft it that way? And I think that's also helped me build my network and also become better in my practice. And so those would be my things.
That's great. Yeah. And really great advice, I think, and very, very consistent with a lot of the themes that we're trying to cover in this podcast series. You know, one of the things we really wanted to focus on in particular in this episode is sort of, how do you get that foundation of knowledge and that skill set that is sort of our stock and trade as lawyers? Like, how does one acquire that? And then once you acquire it, how do you continue to keep it fresh and develop it? And so, you know, both of us shared the opportunity to have worked at the SEC starting out in our careers, and not everybody works at the SEC, obviously. What do you think people can do to really get that grounding in a particular area of the law, like the securities laws?
Well, I'm thinking about the two of you, Dave and Liz, and it's something that both of you have in spades, which is, I feel a real passion for what it is that you do. When you read a no action letter, when you're drafting a blog on something the SEC has done, when you're reading a rule release, a passion for the substance, for the details, for what it means. And so for me, that's a big part of it. Just find something in securities law that you're passionate about. I'm a lifetime learner. The thing that I'm most excited about in my current role, beyond our purpose as a firm, is that I have so much to learn. It's a privilege to be able to learn so much in a lifetime, right? And so for me, that's the thing, is like having that passion around learning, around developing skills. Now, I have forgotten so much more securities law knowledge. There's so much. But the thing that I took from my time at the SEC particularly, and this is another Marty Dunnism, Marty lived in College Park, you know, Dave, and I lived in Silver Spring, and we'd have conversations around taking the metro from our homes to the office and what you do with that 30 to 45 minutes or an hour. And something that Marty did that I copied was that he would go home, bring every day when he left his office at the SEC, something to read. It could be a rule release, a no action letter, a treatise, whatever it is. He'd read it on the way home and then he'd read it on the way back to work. He'd put it down and pick up the next thing. He'd read it on the way home and read it back to work. And I did the same thing when I was there. I wanted to really understand shareholder proposal stuff. So I had this ongoing set of things in shareholder proposals that I was reading, old releases going back to the 1930s, treatises that had been written, old no action letters. And I literally would pick a different thing every night and I'd take it home and I'd read it on the way home. And then I'd take it and read it back. And if I didn't finish it that day, I just continued it until I mastered it. And so over time, my knowledge of securities law just continued to grow. Like there was an era where I was really into, is this thing a security or is it not? So all these 2A1, 2A3, I would go back and I'd look at the no action letters and I'd pick one area of no action letters and then the next one, then I'd read a case on it and the next one. And so the point is, I think that is something that everyone is capable of doing if you're passionate about it and you're committed to learning it. That's one. And then the second thing I would say is I always read the statute, or if it's a rule release, I always read the rule release. I don't like the law firm memos are wonderful. So thank you. Thank you and your firms for doing them. And yet there's almost always some detail that's in a footnote, that's in the back of the release, that is just too small for the law firm to put in the release, but still very helpful and understanding. And so even in my current role, when there are rule developments that are material to our firm and I'm trying to understand them, I don't just rely on like that secondary source. I try to go back and like, what did the original release say? What did the legislation say? What did the actual no action letter say? What were the footnotes in there? Because there's often a lot of goodness hidden in those details.
That's great advice, Keir. And one thing I appreciate about Dave's memos is that he does also refer to the footnotes. So thank you, Dave. And Keir, I think you're being modest in how much you've forgotten about the securities law too. So
it's very nice.
I
don't know.
Well, you are a GC now. You have to stay on top of a crazy number of both legal and business issues. But you do also seem to remain fully up to speed on changes and practice developments from the securities law world. I think you've given us a little bit of a taste for your passion and how you do that. But are there particular resources and strategies that you would recommend to other folks for maintaining a deep and current understanding of the field?
Well, first, I try to read anything that the two of you post. So that's a starting point. Sincerely.
Here we have at least one reader out there.
That's right. Clear.
But you find commentators, writers, bloggers, authors, lawyers that you think are really good and that you think do a good job. And that's usually my starting point for reading stuff. And so I read a lot of stuff all the time. I try to read all of the blogs and some of the no action, some of the law firm memos and things of that nature. The challenge of being a GC, to be honest, there are lots of challenges, but one of the biggest challenges is that you have to accept that you're no longer a subject matter expert. I love securities law. I love the proxy rules. I love governance. I love disclosure, 34 Act reports, all of those things. The harsh reality is that I no longer have the luxury of doing those things myself. And so as a GC, a lot of it for me is first surrounding myself with really strong lawyers, capable people, but then really relying on them in the places where I need to and asking, partnering with them to focus on the things that are most important. So I'll give you an example. So today in one of my conversations, we had a securities law issue that we were trying to analyze, could have pretty significant implications for the firm. And there were kind of rules that were underlying the conversation. And of course, there were facts underlying the conversation. And the challenge for me in that conversation was, if I weren't the GC, if I was a subject matter expert, I'd really want to geek out, like, what are the rules say? What are the guys, like all of those sorts of things. I don't have that luxury. I only had an hour with the team who had that ability to do the geeking out. And so a lot of it for me is really identifying the key kind of analytical points that are most critical to my own analysis. So, okay, I understand this is the test. This is what the rule says. When you apply that rule, how does it typically apply in this fact pattern? Has Fenner ever looked at this consideration? I looked at that issue and so forth. The point is, the strategy is not me reading every detail of the rule. I read what my team gives me, the memo, but the strategy is like testing the analysis, testing the logic, applying kind of my experience in other places to this fact pattern, but really relying on the expertise of my team to help us get to the right outcome. I think the least productive thing to do is to micromanage every single aspect of that to second guess. It's one thing to challenge, to probe, to test. It's a totally different thing to second guess. And that, I think, is the real challenge. And so for me, developing a deep and current understanding is reading as much as I can. You know, I go to things, it's very difficult because I'm used to being on the panel. Now I try my best to just be an active listener, not being on the panel, listening to what's happening on the panels. I try to read as much as I can. But I also try my best to rely on my team. And it's that combination of things that help me keep up to speed. Because when I came out of the SEC, my specialty, so to speak, was probably more of the proxy rules, shareholder proposals, some things since the Securities Act. Then in private practice, you get repeat questions. I did 8K questions a million times, certain proxy questions 100 times, 10K. In my role now, I'm responsible for broker-dealer law, for investment advisory law, for FINRA regs, for SEC regs, for state registration requirements, for state insurance requirements. I think I'm an okay, smart person. That is far too much for me to reasonably expect I can master all of that. And so thankfully, I have a really strong team of SME subject matter experts on each of those things. So my role is to put them in position to master the things that they're advising on and learn enough to be conversant and to read everything that I'm given by them. And that's probably the best that you can do as a general counsel to maintain that deep and kind of breadth of understanding to do your job really well.
I think that trust that you put in your team too probably inspires them to work harder and perform their best. And so it's a two-way street.
I hope so. You got to
Yeah, I'm
ask them,
sure it
Liz. I hope
does.
that's right.
Yeah, well, I can't imagine it doesn't.
Maybe we'll have them on the podcast next.
Yeah.
I think, and a lot of what you just said makes me think about this concept in that it's hard to sort of gain the knowledge, right, and develop the skill set. But then the really hard thing, I think, to learn as a lawyer or to teach other lawyers to do is to then apply that knowledge and synthesize that information and tailor your response to the audience to whom you are giving the advice. And you have a very unique perspective, I think, here because you've done it at the SEC, you've done it in private practice, you've done it in various roles in-house. What is your approach generally to trying to, make the right judgments and apply that knowledge base that you have, and then consider the business aspects and consider the audience to whom you are communicating that advice?
Yeah, it's a great question because I have sat in a number of seats. You know, at the SEC, you're giving advice to the public, to lawyers, to law firms. At my last role at the SEC, I was advising an SEC commissioner, very different kind of role. You go to private practice and you're advising clients on topics, and then you flip and you're in-house and you're receiving the advice, right? But you're also giving advice. Like I've got internal clients. My clients are the executives and my other firms at the boards of directors. And so here's a couple things for me. The first thing is I try to think about what's the context in which I'm being asked to give advice. So I take a board meeting, for example. You sit in a boardroom, and most times, most of the other people in that room are not lawyers. And they're relying on you as the lawyer to explain a legal concept, to help them understand a fact pattern, an issue, an opportunity, whatever it may be. And so, in that setting, I try to imagine myself on the other side of me, on the other side of that communication. If I'm a non-lawyer, and what would I want to hear? What would I understand? What would I need to be, have explained for me, you know, in very basic terms? And that guides really each of my conversations. So I've sat in boardrooms where, you know, other lawyers will come in and they start talking, you know, this motion and this, that, and the other. And it's all very complicated legalese. And I'm following, I'm a lawyer. Okay, I get what they're saying, but I'm looking around the room and it's like vacant stares. Like the board is not following. You got to bring them with you. And so one of the things is like, am I using plain English? Thinking back to the old days at the SEC. Am I using a bunch of jargon and acronyms and complicated words and phrases? Like, what is the most simple way that I can communicate what needs to be communicated to this audience? And can I anticipate what their questions are going to be? And I think that's probably the next most important thing. Like, you're on the agenda for a reason. You're updating the board. So yesterday, for example, we had an audit committee meeting and I gave an update on our litigation and regulatory posture. And in getting ready for it, I try to think, okay, you know, these people aren't following what's happening every day in our cases. They may not even remember what the cases are. And they're not going to want to hear about all of the cases. They're going to want to hear about the big ones. And so as I'm preparing for that meeting, I'm like, okay, what are the big cases? What do they need to know about what the underlying subject matter of what those cases are? What's at stake? What's the dollar amount, if it's a dollar amount, et cetera? And most importantly, like, what's my judgment on those cases? Like, am I concerned? Is the situation green? Is it red? Is it yellow? With respect to rulemaking, to regulatory, same thing. Like, the two of you, like me, are following all of these White House executive orders. You're looking at what's happening at the SEC. They're not doing any of that stuff. And by the way, they shouldn't have to. My job is to be the interpreter in chief and to come in and say, here are all of the things that my team is looking at, and here's the implication for you, right? And so I think that that is by far the most, for me at least, has been the most effective thing. And then here's the last thing. So Dave, you may know this. Liz, I don't know if you know this. So I stutter, I stammer, actually. I really, really, really work on it. When I get excited, you'll catch it from time to time. Blah, 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 blah. Like, right? And so the other thing for me is a communication isn't effective if people can't hear you. And so I actually try to practice, especially for like audit committee or board meetings, like literally I will, even if I don't script the whole thing out, I'll have my bullet points and I'll practice, okay, say it in a deeper voice because it's more impactful, and breathe and go as slow as you can and make sure you're articulating the things. And in the moment, I'm looking around the room to make sure that people are still following. And so to me, those are by far the most important things. Last thing, one of the things is, am I asking the right questions? And that I think is probably the most important thing in the preparation process is like, do I really understand it all? Like, I'm trying to be a learn it all, not a know it all. So what are the questions that I haven't asked? So when my team is briefing me for something and I'm asking, we're going through, and I'm like, at the end, I try to pause and ask, is there something that I didn't ask that I should have asked? Or is there something that's top of mind for you that we have not talked about? Are there other things out there that other people are asking that I'm not asking? Because I only know what's in my head, but I can benefit from the thoughts of all these other people. And so that's the other thing that I try to do, is ask myself those questions in advance of those sessions so that I can anticipate the questions that other people might have for me in that room. And I'm prepared with, you know, with the answer and timing and all that sort of stuff.
A lot of good sound bites and nuggets in there, Kier. I can't wait to go back and listen to this again. Interpreter in chief, a title I like. So now for the question that we've all been waiting for. You served as general counsel in your two most recent roles. And as you mentioned, you have to keep track of a very broad array of issues in those roles. But it's also clear from this conversation that securities laws remain near and dear to your heart, as they should. And we all know that every securities lawyer has a favorite statutory regime. In your opinion, which is better, the 33 Act or the 34 Act?
Oh man, I want to waffle on this one. Okay, here's what I think my answer is. I think the answer is the 34 Act.
Oh.
But before I get to that, let me say, I do love the 33 Act. The 33 Act is kind of kooky. Like, you think about so much of the 33 Act are these like very intangible ideas. What's a security? What's an offer? Right. And so I do love that part of the Securities Act. And like, that's something that I think keeps your mind occupied for the entirety of your career. Right. But if I had to choose, I would probably choose the 34 Act for a couple of reasons. One is just the sheer breadth of the 34 Act. Like, the 33 Act, in some ways, it's like a moment of time statute, offer, mm-hmm. sale, right? The 34 Act is like everything else afterwards, right? Like ongoing disclosure obligations. Think about all of the things that have sprung out of the proxy rules. Like, who knew? Who knew in the 40s when you created the proxy rules, 14A, that this whole realm of institutional engagement and shareholder proposals and annual meeting, like all of that would evolve from that. Investment management. So much depth, right? Investment advisory, broker-dealer rules, exchanges, all of those things. And so, and then just basic 34 Act reporting, K's, Q's, Form 8Ks, all of those things, beneficial ownership rewarding, the Williams Act. Like it literally, so in some ways, it's almost an unfair question because the 34 Act is so much broader. It has so much more depth than the 33 Act, even though I really do like the 33 Act. So I'd say the 34 Act is my favorite.
It's like choosing your favorite child.
It is. But you have favorites. We all have favorites.
There's no wrong answers. No wrong answers. So.
And a lot to love in both acts. I will say I was a little surprised because earlier you talked about your interest in what is a security. So keeping us on our toes till the very end here.
That's the point, right?
Yep. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been such a great conversation.
Thank you both for the opportunity. I always love talking with the two of you, seeing your faces. The audience doesn't know that I could see you right now, and I love that. So thank you both for the opportunity and the invitation.
Absolutely. For those who are listening, we want to thank you as well. Stay tuned for future episodes of Mentorship Matters with Dave and Liz. If you have a topic or a guest who you think would be great for the podcast, feel free to contact Dave or me by LinkedIn or by email. Thanks.